welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 139, Buddhas Never Leave, Tulkus, Three Bodies, and Reincarnation.
Buddhas never leave. They don't go away. They will leave a particular body to teach impermanence to people and how precious their humanoid body is. So Siddhartha, body, which became Shakyamuni Buddha, then he sort of, okay, I'm finished now, I'm leaving. Just after telling his main disciple, Shariputra, some months after that, you know, I could stay like 1,000 years if I wanted to. Because by a Buddhahood, you don't have, it's a sci-fi thing, you don't have an ordinary body. You know, you have this magic body. Actually, people, even in this translation, they're calling illusory body. I never call it illusory body. Maya Deha, Gyulu, it's called in Tibetan, Maya Deha. But the word Maya, which is means illusion, so it's not wrong, but it's a little rude. Illusory means like something not quite real. But magic body, the word also Maya means magic. So Buddha's mother's name was Maya Devi, magic goddess, that meant. And magic, we have a little bit positive connotation usually, right? We like, you know, oh, magic, oh, that's magical, we say. So it's really magic body. That once you're a Buddha, you have a magic body. So they never leave, A. B, Tulku, which means Nirmanakaya, body of emanation. Do you know about the three bodies of Buddha? Does everybody know about a full-fledged Buddha in Mahayana has what's called three bodies? And sometimes four, I mean, they have different ways, but usually three. Do you know, does everyone know that?
No.
No? Well, there's the reality body, which is everything, right? That's the main, that's the real one. That's the ultimate one. That's the nirvanic one. That's the bliss void, indivisible one, et cetera, right? But then, just to sort of deal with the paradox of things, there's said to be what's called the material body or form body. Usually people translate it as form, but I think that's really not so good because it means what's substance body, you know, material body. And then that has two types. One of them is called Sambhogakaya, which means the enjoyment body or the total enjoyment body, the longjhan dokpiku. The complete enjoyment body, like bliss, body of pure bliss, which is not visible to beings unless they're close to that state. You know, they're like high bodhisattvas, 10th stage or something. So it doesn't help regular beings like me, because I can't see it, you know. So then he has Nirmanakaya, which is called body of emanation. And body of emanation is there to interact with all the beings. And that's what Tulku is, a translation of that word, Tulku. Tril means a magical emanation, or again, has a slightly idea of illusory emanation. And that is as many as beings need. There's no limit. So for example, I used to translate for different lamas, but particularly one who lived with us for quite a while, who was the abbot of, former abbot of Tantric College, Taratoku, marvelous man. And in inter-religious dialogues, you know, and he would always get into it with these Christian theologians. Your God is omnipotent, right? Yes. He can do whatever he wants then, right? Yes. How come you only had one son? And then there's the right elaborate kind of, you know, theological reasons are given. And then he would say to that person, well, how many children do you have? Oh, I have four. I remember particularly one Lutheran minister. Oh, I have four. You have four, but omnipotent God can only have one. You know, Well, and then more theological reasons. And then, you know, they went on and all tried all kinds of ways to, could he have had a son, for example, yes, could he have had a son or daughter that would be in some other country or culture that nobody would ever heard of in the Middle East? Could he have done that? No, he would never have done that because this one son took care of the whole problem. But those people don't know about him, right? And then you say the people who don't know about him, they're doomed to hell anyway, even however holy they were, however great. Yes. Well, you know, so he would get stumped like that. So finally, at the end of it, he says to me in Tibetan, "Oh, well," he said, "I guess the old boy only had one bullet in him." Referring to the omnipotent God. So then I burst out laughing, of course. He said it in Tibetan, right? So then my face turned red because the theologian was like, "What did he say? What did he say?" And I had to think of something. I thought the joke might be a little much. So, well, he just said that it's really fascinating, all kinds of ideas. But then, I went on to explain that the Buddhists feel, even though they don't say Buddha's omnipotent, they never say that. But nowadays I use the word omnicompetent. You know, is capable of doing whatever needs to be done, sort of thing. So omnicompetent, you know, like he can't just do everything for everybody, but is very competent interacting with what people are doing to help it be successful. And you know, the point is, if you become a Buddha, you don't have to do anything after that. You're sort of there, you know. But you're everywhere, right? But you can do everything, and you do automatically do it. And the reason you do it is because people's need draws you from your place of like the clear light where you are the sort of medium, you are the nirvana, your body is the nirvana, in which the beings are swimming, thinking they're fighting upstream or downstream, and they have to conquer the ocean, and therefore losing and failing to conquer it because they can. And then you're there to do whatever it is. So you can rain embodiments and incarnations on people if it would help. Okay? So this is the amazing thing. So you know, it's magical and miraculous, the vision of reality of the Buddhists. It's sci-fi. It's way ahead of the time. In the Avatamsaka Sutra, not even esoteric, when Buddha starts to teach, and this one made me mad when I first discovered it. I'd already been studying maybe 15, 20 years, you know, working hard, meditating, and trying to, of course, failing mostly, but still trying hard, you know, studying. And in the Avatamsaka Sutra, the Buddha sits there, and first of all, other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas come from all kinds of other universes, in a huge stream of beings coming from outside this universe to witness his teaching, because it's always a great thing. And there's even parking problems, because they come in giant 1,000-story towers. Forget about Trump. 1,000-story towers made of woven flower petals with 10,000 bodhisattvas in each one, from all different directions, and they specify from the northwest this one, from the east that one, from the west the other one. And they arrive around where the Buddha is. It's like a close encounter of the umpteenth third time. And then it takes a long time describing all these creatures and things, and then deities come and sci-fi kind of creatures, and they're all around Buddha. Somehow all of them, Buddha doesn't need an interpreter, because when he speaks any word, everybody who hears it in their own language. He also doesn't need media and Facebook Live, because everybody in the audience sees the Buddha as if they were right in front of him. He has like really multimedia ability. He has. But that's all fine. I was all going with all that. It was tiresome to keep reading it because it's sort of repetitive with different names. It's beautiful, but repetitive. And it's like incantatory. And then the Buddha does something called the Lion's Stretch, Simha Vijarambita Samadhi, the Lion's Stretch. And when a lion gets up, or a cat, you know how they go? They go like this. You know? They kind of stretch out. Vijarambita, it means. It could also have another meaning. But he does that Samadhi, at which point he turns blue, in that instance, they say he's manifesting oneness with Vairochana Buddha, who you talked about in the head chakra. And the body Buddha, that is, of the five Buddhas. And then from a tuft of hair on the middle of his forehead, little transistor thing, a light ray zoomed out into this huge audience from multiple universes. And the minute that light ray touched the sight of all this vast host of people, every single one of them had an anticipatory experience, like a trailer preview of themselves becoming a Buddha sometime in some universe, and experiencing being a, you know, going to being in the palace, leaving the palace, going on the ascetical hardship routine for many years, becoming perfectly enlightened, teaching people, and how it felt to be a Buddha. They had a trailer of their future life in whatever other universe of themselves being a Buddha. And when I first read that, I thought, that's no fair. If Buddha can do that, why am I working so hard? You know, everybody can just shoop, experience themselves in the future being a Buddha, because if you experience it, then you know it's there, and then you have really powerful motive. Because, of course, being a Buddha is apparently the juiciest experience possible. And Yenla's not afraid to talk about it. Actually, even in people translating from Tantra, they translate this Lenje, you know, Lenje Dechen. They translate it as innate, or some really miraculous, mysterious people translate it as co-emergent. They have all kinds of stupid translations. Meanwhile, Lenje means, you know, the bliss born by union. Lenje means born together. But the born together means union of male and female. So the proper translation of the word is orgasmic, which doesn't mean an ordinary ejaculative procreative orgasm. It means this, what Yala mentioned, heart orgasm, brain orgasm. You know, the whole being enters into a permanent orgasmic state. But nobody will translate that. They're like, something weird. They're thinking about cleaning the sheets, you know. Meanwhile, there's no sheets. It's the whole universe. It's like you see the leaf over there, and it's like, it's a bliss just as intense as orgasm, seeing the leaf on the tree outside in the window there. It's like that. So orgasmic is good, and that's great actually, because it connects to Wilhelm Reich. How many of you have ever heard of Wilhelm Reich in this room? Some of you, that's good. He didn't know about this kind of thing, but he naturally has discovered it actually. And he was a great scholar, student of Freud, you know, discovered that enlightenment in the body, you know. And he wrote his famous book, was called The Function of the Orgasm. But he had a different definition of it. It wasn't just the genitally, what they call genitally organized orgasm. It was a total body orgasm that he talked about, that even ordinary people can have if they can kind of stay cool, you know, and not get overexcited, sort of, yeah. Unusual people. And his name is Wilhelm Reich. He was very persecuted in Germany. He was originally German. Persecuted in Russia because he thought Russia at first was going to be more open, you know, after the revolution in the 1920s. And then he was persecuted in Germany, and then he was persecuted here in the U.S. actually.
He died in prison.
Because, you know, the whole, you know, happiness in most countries in the world until now has been more or less illegal. Because if people have too much of it, then they won't work for the state or the high priest or whoever it is that they want. And they will just, why should I go fight the war? I'm feeling good. I feel too good. Right, James, was that James? James Brown? I feel good. I knew that I would. Right? That's what Buddha said at the morning under the tree. He said, I feel good. And I knew that I would. So our job at this stage is to imagine that. Yenla's, all he's been teaching you is from those chakra system, is imagining that about your, you know, and opening those chakras. And then my job is to try to, from the ordinary level, because in order to do that effectively, you know, like the chakra system, for example, chakra system is not wetware. It's software. So we all have central nervous systems, which are the whole body, not just the brain and the head. The reason there's a lot of slimeware, I call it, in the head, is that most of the senses are collected there in the human being, except for the skin sense, you know, but most of the organs are in the head. And but our whole body is our nervous system, actually. And the central channel is the central part of that body, and then the chakras fit on it. But, you know, in India, you'll find Gela. I don't know if you didn't travel around India that day. You probably didn't see the map, though. But you can find funny little books in Indian bookstores, spiritual bookstores, of some doctor in, like, Andhra Pradesh or somewhere, who's dissecting dogs looking for the chakras. You know? Or looking even, and probably human, of course, but they don't show that. So they're looking for a chakra. Where's the chakra, you know? And that's silly, because it's a programming thing. And to program that, you have to have a very powerful confidence in your own imagination. And to have a really vivid and powerful confidence in your own imagination, you have to have retrieved your imagination. Because where is our normal imagination? I can't tell you how many people over the years, and Gyanla, I'm sure more, because he's a real teacher, a spiritual teacher, I'm just an academic one, but in teaching in sort of middle places like here, who say, oh, I can't visualize, oh, I don't have a powerful imagination, I can leave that to an artist or something. But that's not true. Everyone can visualize, and everyone does visualize. And actually, when you look at this flower here, you're visualizing that flower. That is to say, there's a bunch of, supposedly, science tells you, photons that bounce off some molecules of that thing and then go to your optic nerve. And then your mind sort of just reads it off reality. It's sort of the naive person thinks. But actually, someone who studies that, you have an image of a purple flower. Is that a peony, I guess? Is that a peony?
Yeah. Smells nice.
Yeah? That's a peony? Oh, thank goodness. Purple peony. And you imagine, you retrieve that from your data bank and your imagination, and you wrap that over all the buzzing, blooming light energies that are coming at your optic nerve, which itself is a bunch of energies organizing to receive it. And then you recognize and you go, ah, purple peony, quote unquote. And you feel you captured it with that word. But of course, it's a miracle, that flower. Every atom in that flower has a Bodhisattva Samantabhadra in it. And even Mr. and Mrs. Samantabhadra are in every atom in the flower. I mean, everything is not what you think. And that shouldn't be so startling to you in modern, even though it's materialism, that shouldn't be startling with you, because, right, you're all sitting here solidly on the floor, right, on your cushions and pillows, have your body here, you did some meditating, breathing, right, you're really there. Then science would tell you you're mostly empty atoms with little electrons and molecules being around, and that this sense of yourself as a solid thing is a totally construction, it's an illusion. So therefore, emptiness, what we did a little meditating yesterday, emptiness, selflessness, is by constantly thinking about that. By thinking, when you see something, and it seems like it's really over there, then you realize, well, that's how it looks. But I mustn't just invest it with having intrinsic identity, that is to say, being really a box on the floor, or really a floor, massively being a floor. Objectively being a floor, I must realize that it's a whole bunch of relationalities that I'm having that then I bring up out of my routinized imagination, the idea of a floor, and I slap it on there, you know, and then I think I've recognized it. You follow me? But actually I've fitted it into my preconceived idea of the universe, is what I've done. A very powerful and energetic act of vivid imagination. To see an ordinary thing and recognize it. So when you reflect on your relationality to that floor, to that seeming quote-unquote floor, or as the Buddhist epistemologists say, when you see floor and not quote floor, when you first see floor, you're not sure what it is, in other words, but you kind of are there with it. Then you are eroding the rigidity of what's called your intrinsic identity habit attached to objects. So you are beginning to become more self-responsible and self-aware of your role in imagining your world, not only yourself in the world and your sort of identity of what you are, what you're capable of, who you are, but also what the world is. and you're eroding your conviction about you're I'm this and it's that. Do you follow me? And you're more merging with that world. And that's you're becoming therefore more enlightened. And as you do that in a gradual process, which takes a long time, but you continue to do that, your imagination becomes more free of its, and you become more master of your imagination. And then you really could begin to start really move your chakras, you know, you could really, or then of course, be a deity, you know. Be a medicine Buddha, or whatever, Tara, you know, if you're doing esoteric things. But you can't do that unless you know that it's another construct, like your ordinary self is a construct. So then you no longer want to construct, you know, you're no longer stuck where your imagination is only on the ordinary construct. And then you're able to create an extraordinary construct. And then when you do Tantra, either Dzogchen or Dzogrim or Kedim, you know, what I call creation stage, which they call develop, other people call development stage, I call creation stage, because you're recreating a world, actually. And you, because emptiness doesn't let the world disappear. That is the very keyest point. Emptiness doesn't mean it all disappears. You can have an experience of yourself and everything disappearing, which is a valuable one. But you shouldn't misinterpret it to think that that experience is the ultimate end-all thing. It is not. That experience is just a revelation of the constructiveness of the world temporarily, where it seems to disappear. The point is, that one Lama I know really brilliantly said, he said that your relative self has been imprisoned since beginningless time within your construct of an absolute self. It's like a kind of cage around it that you just have to be whatever you think you are at whichever time, and you really absolutely that. So when you look for that ultimate self, like we just did a tiny bit of the other day, and don't find it, then what is your sense of it having been there disappears, and since it's been so entwined with the relative self for so long, your sense of a relative self also disappears. You follow, like, because you merge with the absence of the absolute self, and you sort of have a feeling as if your last absolute thing is a feeling of merging into an absolute where you're not there and nobody's there. So that, and then the misinterpretation is that absoluteness is where you disappear, is reality. That's the reality. Nirvana means just you extinguish yourself. And Western people all thought that's what Buddhists were like. That's why they all thought, again, for centuries, that Buddhists were all depressed and so unhappy. Then when they saw some Tibetan looking happy, they thought, oh, they couldn't be doing Buddhism. Why are they happy? Because they think it's all suffering and they're trying to extinguish themselves and destroy themselves. And the Western persons, after materialism, after the 17th century and 18th century, they can easily disappear. Just shoot yourself. They think, which of course they have a big wake-up call when they don't disappear, of course. And they're reborn in a body that has a birthmark on the temple where they had the gun placed. And then they're discovered by Ian Stevenson from Virginia or his colleagues. Sometimes if you die a violent death, then you have birthmarks in your next embodiment. He has discovered. So there's a lot of data on that. And then that's why people think, oh, gee whiz, where's Buddha? Buddha disappeared. He attained power in nirvana. And they wrongly translated it as final nirvana. And even rainbow body can be misunderstood that way. People can think, oh, he turned into a rainbow and then he disappeared. And that he was had relief from that. And even Book of the Dead, it says, you see the light and you go to the heart of Vairochana or of Akshobhya or of Ratnasambhava or of Amitabha. And then you're liberated. And then you don't have to be reborn. And so then people, again, that people misunderstand, think, oh, great, that's all referring to disappearing. But wait a minute, if that's so, then why are these Buddhas still running around teaching? If they all disappeared to be Buddhas. If the ultimate thing is just disappeared, just go around and shoot everybody. That would solve the problem. If everybody could just disappear. But the point is, emptiness doesn't mean an absolute thing apart from the relative world. Emptiness itself is the relative concept of the absolute, but it means that everything, including an idea of nirvana, including an experience, separated, distinctive experience of nirvana, is relative only. So, absolutely speaking, this is all nirvana. you know. But relatively speaking, approaching this with wisdom rather than ignorance is different from approaching or being stuck in this based on ignorance, thinking you're not it, in other words. You follow me? Is that clear? It should be clear one time through. Then when you try to rethink, it might be difficult. But it's okay. So Gelah is definitely the reincarnation of Medicine Buddha. And definitely, I hereby pronounce him such. And of Yutogyan Nyingbo. And I can do that confidently because he's doing the work that they want to see done. In the poem here that is translated from Tibetan, it says in Yutok's song, he says a lot of things about how he's this and that. And then he says, you know, he wants to rain, or I forget, he wants to rain medicine on all beings. Although there are many Bodhisattva prayers like that. Bodhisattva actually prays, I want to be the medicine that everybody needs. So the actual pill, I want to be pills. The Nirmanakaya body of emanation is not only persons, seeming persons. It can also be planets, whole planets. If Obi-Wan Kenobi was a Bodhisattva in the inconceivable liberation, or an emanation body person, you know, Jedi master. But if that meant if George had taken that to the level of where he was the Force, when he shuddered in the early Star Trek, or I forget which one, where the Death Star destroyed a planet and 7 billion people, the number 7 billion is funny, very prophetic. Lucas doesn't know what he's channeling. 7 billion people dying, and it's a disturbance in the Force. But a Bodhisattva in the inconceivable can make another planet for them, have them land there quickly and carry on with their lessons. It isn't that you're saving, they can't save themselves, because they can only save themselves by coming to an understanding. But it's an omnicompetent teacher. If they lose their planet and their physical, their coarse bodies, then a Buddha could make another planet, very similar, and land them. Just catch them on the planet. Here, okay, now get to work. Go on retreat with Menla. Be a doctor, heal some people, get busy. There's no escape. That's the key thing. And luckily, no need to escape, if you understand where you are. But very important to know there's no escape in a certain sense, because, you know, what is our problem? Our problem is, if we are unenlightened, and so many of you may be, I'm sure a lot of you are more enlightened than me, for sure, Gelah sure is, but it's very clear to know that when you're unenlightened, what it means is, it doesn't mean you don't have a light in your head, or you can't see bright lights. It means that you have a distorted sense of yourself, that there's something in there that's the real you, that's separate from everything else, and different from everything else. And therefore, if you have an experience of being different from everything else, and everything else disappearing, you could easily misinterpret that as being, that's my real self, and think that your real self is a state apart from everything. And even what we call dualistic Buddhists, you know, the Buddhists who think that nirvana is separate from samsara, which we call the individual, I call it, not to be disparaging, I call it the individual vehicle Buddhism, which in modern times now is mostly Theravada. But in ancient times, there were 18 different schools. And in China, they have a different, some few of them still survive. And Tibet, they have a slightly different one than Theravada. But they're similar, they're very similar to Theravada. So the Buddha even let people think that, but he totally warned that any kind of state of things disappearing is not nirvana. So therefore, not to worry. And then the other point is this. You know, that they, even if Gelah was a reincarnation, not only the communist, but, you know, official. And he came in here in big pedigree. Here's my reincarnation certificate. You know, I'm a famous lama from many lives. If he did that, then what would it be our tendency to do, since we're kind of childish people? Oh, he will save me. Oh, he'll be my guru. Oh, just depend on him. Oh, yeah. Then don't do it. Then he'll be upset. Then the guru will say, Yes, of course. If you gain some enlightenment, some knowledge from a teacher, you should be grateful and happy with the teacher and try to learn more if you find the teacher is reliable. But if you're depending on the teacher for your enlightenment, you're putting the wrong burden on the teacher because you have to learn. You know, they call it shenyan tensun, the way of relying on the spiritual friend, literally, or the spiritual teacher. And the way of relying, the most important thing is realizing and understanding what the teacher is teaching. That's the most important thing. Not just going and fluffing on the teacher, oh, Guruji, save me. That's, Kaila said that during the initiation. He said, too much guru dependency is not good. If you meet a group, a Buddhist group, let's say, or a Hindu group, any kind of group, where everybody is just slobbering over the teacher all the time, and then, of course, around such a teacher, there's all kind of infighting, and who's closer to the teacher, and who's more, and who's advanced disciple. It's a tremendous bunch of BS going on, which I don't mean Buddhist studies. And that's even, and then if you found it, that's a bad group then. That means that teacher is not pushing the responsibility back on the student. Even Dalai Lama himself, you know, in a teaching I once was at a Tara initiation that he did in India. And in India, they're very into, you know, respecting the guru, you know. The word guru means heavy. It means heavy, literally like heavy. That's what guru means. It's a root word, root meaning in India, in Sanskrit, and in Hindi. And so they're ready to touch his feet. The Indians have wonderful gesture when they touch the feet and the dust of your feet, Guruji, which are all beautiful. That's nice, worshiping, respecting the guru. That's a nice thing. It has a small part of relating to a teacher. It's a preliminary small part. The real part is doing the teaching and understanding it. And then becoming like the teacher. And so in that sense, if a teacher is self-confident, that's good because it really wants you to be self-confident. The student is supposed to be self-confident. If you're going to try to become a sci-fi creature, which is a Buddha, which is a So then what I really wanted to share, I'm going to stop sharing together. Although this is my only time, that's why I hold up the time a little bit again, I apologize. But this is my only thing, this particular time. And that is this. The first starting of the path, and many of you may be along the path, but it's always good to go back to the real beginning. The beginning of the path, after meeting the teaching, either through a teacher, through a book, through a Buddha, whatever it is. In the case of this weekend, it's through Gelug that we're meeting. That's important, and having a sense of confidence in that teaching and teacher by seeing the good qualities of that teaching and teacher, that's also good. But then, the very first thing to meditate and practice is the importance of yourself, the value of yourself. You have been brought up in a culture, whether on the theistic side or the materialistic side of the culture, where you are not important. Actually, and you're taught to think that's great, and you're supposed to be humble, and you're supposed to think that you're very limited, and you're not self-confident, and you even even encourage to despise yourself. Actually, the theistic one, you're a sinner, right? I'm Adam, Eve. If you're a female, Eve is your model. Cause the sin. Tangled up with Kundalini serpent, feather and apple of happiness, and then got kicked out by the authoritarian weirdo out of the garden, Medicine Buddha garden, which is just a silly patriarchal myth. But we were educated to that. And then only someone else can save us because we're so worthless. And Protestantism is that. Calvinism, oh my God, those Swiss people, they're in that heavenly mountain. And they were told that someone was saved ahead of being born, and others, no matter what they did, were finished. So they might as well just work in the watch factory. So the default thing that you're educated in, and then the scientists then are liberating you from that, but you're like 15 cents of cheap chemicals in a bag of water. And you don't really exist. And when you die, then you will revert to your true consciousness, which is a state of non-existence. So you're not particularly valuable either. some jeans came together in the backseat of a Cadillac down by the levee on a Saturday night, and then you suddenly have a body and you think you're important and you're American or whatever you are, and a male or a female, and you're just this 15 cents worth of cheap chemicals to be pushed around by oligarchs and scientists. So, whereas you are none, you yourself are a continuum from an infinite, beginningless life. There's no, you know, well, what, where did it all come from? You know, that's the big question. Buddha says it comes from ignorance, right? That means it doesn't really come at all in one level. On the relative level, it means it's always been there. So you have an infinite continual void. And then now you've become human. You're not living in hell. You're not living in the preta realm of the hungry spirit. You're not living like an animal on a breed farm or, you know, what do they call it, those horrible places, you know, food farm. You're not a titan like a macho, you know, fighting and killing all the time. And you're an asura, you know, and you're not a deity like lounging in a 500-year jacuzzi and doing nothing, being ignorant of your responsibility of the relation to others. And so you are a human being. And you are not really considering yourself. You know, if we had a billionaire in the room, we probably don't have a billionaire. I don't mean to ruin in case someone is, but we probably don't have a billionaire in the room. Why? Because billionaire, every minute is so important. They have to stay, like, stuck. I just lost 15 million. You know, their time is too precious because everything's measured in money. So it's very, very precious. So they wouldn't have time to sit here and try to think about the purpose of the billion or of life, mostly. They wouldn't. They just take some answer. And in the Protestant ethic of Max Weber, the sociologist, they think that having the billion kind of proves that God likes them, so they're going to be saved after they die. You know, there's a little element like that. But the church tells them, no matter how many billions you have, if you're a bad guy, it won't happen. But they don't listen to that. They just think, I got a billion. And then they say, shut up, here, I'll build 10 churches for you. Don't tell me anything like that. It's it. So, but the point is this. That billionaire at least thinks every minute of their time is valuable. But what do we do with our spare time? How valuable do we think we really are? Do we really focus on our sadhana, on our mantra, on our whatever, you know, practice, our meditation? Do we really make that the supreme priority of our life by considering ourselves to be at an evolutionary moment from a beginningless time where we have moved through tremendous ethics, generosity, patience? You're beautiful. You're all beautiful people. That means you were very patient in a previous life. Anybody who's really ugly in this life or very angry in a previous life. And if you're wealthy in this life, you were generous in a previous life. And if you're human, you were ethical in a previous life. And if you're intelligent, you cultivated wisdom of selflessness in a previous life. And if you can concentrate well on what you do, you meditate in a previous life. And if you're creative and have high energy to do beautiful and creative things, you practice the transcendence of creativity and creative effort. And so you have this moment. And even if you're elderly and you don't have that many moments, maybe. Although now that you've been initiated into long life, you could stay 100 or 2 years if you feel like it. You need to. You better work at it. But you have, everyone is precious. You know, I did mildly chide Eckhart Tolle, my dear friend, about this moment business. Because the moment depends on what the non-moment is, to have a sense of what the moment is. If you leave people with a materialist ideology intact, that what they really are is nothing, because the minute they die, they have no consciousness, and there's no future continuum of their individual soul existence, so to speak. If you convince them of that, then their moment is a sort of complete just disconnect from everything. And it gives them a palliative of no less worry, and it's very powerful, it gives them a buzz. So that's a nice thing. And if someone's too neurotically worried about everything, afraid they're going to go to hell or whatever it is, or be eaten by a tick, then, and they're having a hard time, then it's nice to say just be in the moment. But it's still a dead zone, the moment. And it's still reinforcing that idea that ultimately extinction is what I'm aiming for. And it's cutting off love and compassion. So you have to first, in addition to the power of now, you have to have the power of infinity. the power of every time, the power of everywhere. Because then you realize that your moment is the cause, is the seed of Buddhahood, or endless wandering meaninglessly in unpleasant life forms. So the moment becomes a really powerful thing to give yourself to, but it's within a causal process. It's within ever-increasing connectivity, the opposite of a moment of disconnect. It's a moment of infinite connect. And that gives you tremendous energy to challenge your own habitual addictive, and they won't even translate klesha, they translate affliction. But the affliction means the suffering itself, not the cause of suffering. So addiction is perfect. Because you know, when you get really mad, it makes you feel good for a short distance. Because you got mad because you were feeling oppressed. So then, you feel powerful for it, but then you get exhausted in 2 minutes, and if you're dealing with a kung fu master, you get all beaten up, because you get all disoriented by getting mad. But, so it's not, it fools you into thinking, though, it's going to make you feel good. Lust, hate, or even sort of closing yourself off, delusion or depression or ignorance. They kind of seem like ignorance is bliss, we hear people say. So it makes you, that's what addiction is. Addiction is something that you think it's helping and it's actually hurting. You follow? But it becomes addictive when you get used to that. Although it makes you worse and worse. So we all say, oh, I know someone who's probably ran away from this room, who's like adjusting the things and then he runs away, who says, well, I'm gonna quit smoking later. Oh, I know, it's killing me. I know, it's so bad. Oh, it ruins my concentration. Oh, yeah. But, and I'm going to do something. Oh, don't bug me. I'm going to do something. Because why? Because they don't care for themselves is why. We are educated. And this is how you meditate Buddhist things. You see, Buddha does not ask for blind faith. He doesn't want blind faith in gurus. He doesn't want blind faith in himself. He doesn't even want blind faith in anything he says. He wants confidence and trust. When people begin to experience something where they get some result, that's what he wants. And so he wants people to get a realistic view of the world and of themselves, and then people will really pull themselves together. You know, because then you have, it's like you got angry many times. All right, my life, I got angry lots of times, lost my temper. And then after years, then whatever I did, it caused a lot of bad echoes and results and had to be fixed laboriously later. And so therefore that moment of it, it was really self-destructive already at the time. I didn't know and was feeling whatever. But actually you learn and then you still feel that powerful inner impulse. But then you have enough experience amassed of the negative consequences that you control it. And that comes up and helps you control it. So if you realize you earned your own life, you meditate, go backwards in meditation, and you think, go back to your birth, do Stan Grof's yoga and hyperventilate, and then remember yourself coming down the birth canal, having your head squeezed or whatever, or being grabbed by forceps if it was a cesarean, and having something squeezed and jerked and pulled. And it's a very painful, difficult thing. But then you go before that. You can go and you can come up with, because like there are people, skilled therapists who can help you do it. And also it's a meditation not that difficult in Buddhism. And when you do that and you realize you've been all these other sorts of things, then you realize, wow, I really became this multi-optional being, a being that's ready to be deprogrammed and reprogrammed. So then it becomes really important to be realistic, because I want to make sure that I program myself to be able to be more, go ever, ever more positive. And that's the real important thing to do in life, with each moment, is to make it just, and then this is the most beautiful thing. In the Samadhi Raja Sutra, they say, who knows cause and effect, who looks carefully at cause and effect, that person comes to know emptiness, you know, voidness, emptiness, freedom, you can even translate emptiness. That person comes to know freedom. Who comes to know freedom, emptiness, that person becomes Vayu in Tibetan, you know, apramatta, becomes carefully mindful of the most minute things. because every minute thing becomes massively important. That's the opposite of disappearing, isn't it? When you know emptiness, it means you know relativity. When you know relativity, it means you're totally there in relativity. That's what your emptiness is. And therefore, if there's something a little off, fixing it becomes everything. If it's an internal, if there's something imbalanced there, fixing it becomes everything. So your full concentration is brought to bear on the moment, on yourself in the moment, to make it positive, though. Not just, I'm in the moment and it's all there for nothing, and so I don't have to worry about it. Worrying itself could be, if you're worrying, just off spinning in some place, in some network of concepts, it's not helpful. But worry, but being behind, focusing concentratedly on making this the best possible moment. That's the kind of moment to moment that you want to have. And to do that, you have to value yourself. Gelma has said, during the initiation, he said at least 10 times, you have to be self-confident. And in all of these books, it's about you have to have the confidence to do that. He's been dealing with Westerners, and they're not confident. And therefore, they make machines like, I have a Tesla, I have a Maserati, to sort of give themselves a sense of power, because they feel very insecure. So our culture indoctrinates us to feel that we are worthless, actually. And the materialists are no better. They say, oh no, those religious people, they're just trying to freak you out to get donations to the church and like send you to the Inquisition or whatever, and we liberated you. But then what are they liberating you? Well, we're liberating you because you're nothing. You don't have to worry. If that were so, fine. They should just blow up the planet. Send in the Death Star. And we'll all vaporize and we'll be extinguished. No struggle to meditate and do nirvana, just to shoot them. Shoot us all ahead of time. But that unfortunately won't work. You trash the bodies, and your subtle mind, which normally is imprisoned or is safe in a little jewel box that Gelma told you about, of white and red softball or baseball. A little white and red little jewel casket. And then there's this little blue spiritual gene, this little blue buzzing, humming thing is inside there. And when you die, this thing falls apart. And then, if you know how, you send it upward toward the upper rebirths or whatever, or whichever you do, but better is human one. And what you're, therefore, your main job in life is to become self-aware, to find that structure, to find that energy at the deepest center of the heart, and then to make that enfold your whole body and everything in the world. And you turn blue there. That's your job. And you can achieve that. And then the Tibetan thing. Now, I was going to do the 12 things, but maybe I used up all the time. I don't get it. You want to talk, you talk. But otherwise, I want to do the 10 things. You want to do them together, or you want to do them? You want me to do them? I wanted to do that. I do. I have to admit. And there are these 10 things that are so cool. About, and I'll try not to complain about translation. I'm always correcting translation stuff. So, where is it? Where is it? There it is. So, after the invocational prayers. So this is, once you know how precious you are, in case you do, then if you really know that, then you would change your whole priorities in life. Your priority would always be what you can do to evolve consciously. Because you are an evolving creature who's constantly changing. And as Wittgenstein once said, the engine of, he used it a little different, but I'm adapting, the engine of evolution never idles. So you don't just stay the same just if you don't do anything. You either get worse or you get better. And then you want to really get lots better before you come to an end of this life, which will happen, unfortunately. We will, this wetware will get sick of it. And then you encounter not only the foundational teaching of loving yourself. That's why people become monks and nuns, by the way. They don't become monks and nuns because they're discouraged about life. On the contrary, the reason they and the word monk and nun is a Western Christian word, so I should say, mendicants. The reason they become male or female mendicants, bhikshus or bhikshunis. The reason they become that is because in an elaborated society, the society supports someone who develops a motivation to evolve to the maximum that they can in their human life. In other words, to use their human body, mind, soul, spirit, language, you know, their whole equipment that they have evolved into by their own tremendous effort over millions of lifetimes. And you've been humans, of course, many times before, but this now, this time you are, you've encountered this teaching. And so it's so important to use your special intelligence to evolve in a maximal way. And it's very frightening to think that you are going to be involved in relativity forever, and you're going to keep running into all the same people, and something you got rid of was a danger, you're going to run into it again. And it's all very, can be very worrisome. And that's why you have to meditate that the default reality is benevolent, it's good. There's Samantabhadra, it's good to sample. It's totally good, the default reality. It's not this evil thing that you're indoctrinated, neither nothing nor a bad thing that you're indoctrinated to think. And then, when you do that, you then look for methods. And then when you look for methods, you find the great vehicle. Soon, you find the individual vehicle, because you are an individual, and you take pity on yourself and shift your priorities, and then you might become, if you were in a society where they supported people who dropped out of everything, and they thought they were the most important and precious people because they dropped out of all the normal productivities and aggressions and self-assertions of ordinary society, and they were looking for the high value of life, the deepest inner value and outer value of life as a mendicant, bhikshu or bhikshuni, then the society supports them. But we live in a society where people are not valued like that, and they won't be supported. So we can't do that. So you become that kind of renunciant, and that's what I'm saying, out of consideration for yourself. I'm so precious. Why would I waste my time like making money just to be able to eat or have a house? That's a waste of time. Somebody can give me a place to be, a shelter and food. And I promise that I only eat one meal a day to make it easy for them. But it might be a big one for a lot, but I only eat one meal a day. So it's not a despair. Buddhists are not despair. They are doing that because they feel, I'm going to use this fabulous life fantastically. It's more difficult for us in this society where we are because we have to take care of ourselves. But no, they won't take care of mendicants, really. But you know, homeless people, they won't really help them to learn and teach. Everyone should have, everyone would be on scholarship, lifelong. But Mr. Fuller, everyone should be on scholarship lifelong, because education is the highest thing a human being can do. They say training, but it is education too. Same. The word is same, adishiksha. And then they would run into the Utok's teaching. And it has this, and especially his highest one. It has 12 special virtues. It brings blessings quickly. That's the first thing. Do you all feel blessed here at Menlo?
Yes,
sure. Does everyone feel blessed?
Yes.
Okay, you had quick blessing, just a couple of days. I'm only here to annoy you part of the time. To challenge you. And it's easy to accomplish. And he makes it seem easy. He does. It's true. And it's simple and convenient. It's very simple. Just realize that Medicine Buddha is here, and everything is fine. And it's comprehensive. It doesn't leave anything out that you have to go find it after you postgraduate. You know? It's comprehensive. It includes all the essential points. It's connected with medicine. That's really amazing. My original guru, Gelam, must have known that when I was a young mendicant. He insisted I study medicine. I totally didn't want to. But you know, and I went to all good schools here, although my family is, you know, some generations ago they were wealthy families on the two sides, but now they printed it all the way, which is lucky for me because I had to work for things, you know, I couldn't just sit back and be spoiled, you know, like a spoiled brat, you know, Well, I am a bit spoiled, but not that spoiled. So, but then I, all these schools, you know, Phillips Exeter, you know, this and that, Harvard, I've been all these great schools, and done study what they ask you to study as well as, but not too well, but pretty well. And, you know, I had no idea what my kidney was doing. Hello, what are you doing on there? I heard you have a, you can have a kidney punch, but I didn't even know what it looked like, where it was. I wasn't a pre-med. I did liver, heart, lung. Only from the Tibetan medicine do they make a thing where anyone can know what's going on inside their body. Not necessarily the subtle nervous system, the chakra level, which is a higher level, but the ordinary pancreas and everything. You know, what are they doing? How many people really, can, do you talk to your kidney? Do you listen to your kidney? I know someone who whose body talked, different body parts talked to them in certain states and made them shape up. Quit smoking. I actually know someone who did. Body said, I don't want any more of that. And they, oh, okay. So the people who do the harmful things to themselves due to harmful addictions are not listening to their body. So, okay, it's connected with medicine. So I think that's really great from the beginning. I received this even then, and I didn't really do it. I didn't have time. I was so whatever. I don't know. Whoever wanted me to do everything. I'm too crazy. Its sequence of practice is clear. But the sequence of practice, first of all, you have to be sure how valuable you are as an ordinary human being. Then you won't waste your life, your time of your life. You know, we have this expression, passing time, you know, hanging out, you know, this kind of thing. You would never do that, because every moment is a taste of Buddhahood, if it's a little better and for others, as well as yourself. It's non-sectarian in its doctrine. That's right. And non-sectarian includes, you know, I was saying to you at an earlier talk that Buddhism is science. And that's when its education is scientific based, because it's based on understanding. Faith, there's a confident faith or trust, is developed through experience with reasons, but not blind faith. Right? That's considered harmful to you. It cripples you. If you believe something for no reason, then you'll believe anything. And you'll be dependent on all kinds of different people. Also, Buddhism is a religion. You can't say. There are those who in the ancient time, in Buddha's own society, in Yuto Yonden Gompo society, in Yuto senior and junior Dzongkhapa society, were mostly agricultural, and relatively few people were educated. Even relatively few people were literate. They had big cities, but the mass of people lived in the villages and so on. And so, for those people who were not educated, it was maybe more of a religion than a science, in the sense that they believed on the basis of their experience, because they had met great teachers, they had met kind people, they had met saintly people, they'd seen magical things probably too, and their imaginations had been lifted by cultural things, stories and plays and dramas and festivals and things like that, rituals. So they believed what they were doing was good, but they didn't think in that life that they would be able to fully understand it. And so for them, it was a religion.
Interstitial music provided by Tenzin Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more, visit TenzinChogyal.com. This podcast is made through the generous support of the Tibet House U.S. membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, please visit tibethouse.us. Complete listing of all upcoming Robert Thurman events, please visit bobthurman.com. And for upcoming events in the heart of the Catskills in Phoenicia, New York at Menla, please visit menla.us, located just 2 hours north of New York City.